Welcome to Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 8, Episode 6, presented by Salonis. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
We're going global, and we're going agency side on this episode of the pod with our very special guest, Bethann Kamakau, Global CEO, VML YNR Commerce, based in New York. Though we connected to Bethann through our friends at the World Retail Congress, which is happening in Paris mid-April. And Bethann will be on a panel with a friend of ours from the pod, Ira Kalish, and you will be there too, right?
Indeed I will, somehow or other. Now, just to be clear, the Paris we're talking about is Paris, France, not Paris, Texas, which would be a lot easier for me to get to. But somehow I'm going to suck it up and just struggle through a trip to Paris. But based upon our experience at the World Retail Congress last year, I think it's worthwhile. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the panel as well as the whole program. Looks super interesting.
Yeah. Now, while I won't be able to make it this year, you will. We also have an offer for our listeners, thanks to our friends at WRC. So we'll put an offer with an offer code in the show notes, and you can get a nice discount, come and join you and Bethann and Ira. It's good. It's great roundup. It's great roster of speakers. Last year, we were there in Barcelona. This year, in Paris, France. Let's get right to the news of the week. I mean, let's start where we must, the Super Bowl and Taylor Swift. I mean, Temu. Let's talk about Temu. And boy, they just dropped a lot of money, I guess.
Yes. You waded into this, though, because the big news is that everybody, including you, but I will point out if people go back, not me, has been saying Temu the wrong way. That was what blew up. I mean, many things blew up on social media, but people being so shocked that the company is actually called Temu, not Temu. So I think that's actually more important. But yes, they also dropped a lot of money.
Yeah.
They also dropped this campaign called Shop Like a Billionaire, which took me a little while to figure out. But apparently the idea is that things are so cheap, you can buy almost anything you want.
Or
we have a wide range. Yeah. Yeah. A billion things. So, but dropped a lot of money. Apparently it was quite successful in driving a lot of incremental traffic to their website. But yes, my big takeaway is that, thank you, I've been pronouncing Temu right all along. Don't get me started on Shein or Shine or Sheen or whatever. So
about that. Well, so I guess they're partying like it's 1999. Let's just spend a lot of money on the Super Bowl and everything will work out fine. Let's skip over from the Super Bowl and let's talk about the macro world of inflation and economics. We like to start there. And there's some news that I think the listeners would be interested in.
Yeah, well, I have a personal commitment to not talk about macroeconomics every single podcast, but there was a big week for some news here that I actually think is fairly important. One is that in the U.S. anyway, we got a couple pieces of data around inflation, and the headline there is that inflation continues to run a bit hotter than was hoped for and expected, which caused some Wall Street gyrations, because the big takeaway from that is that we're probably not going to get interest rate cuts in March, and we're probably not going to get nearly the degree of interest rates that Wall Street's been hoping for this coming year. So a little bit of premature celebration, I think, on Wall Street that got doused by the hotter than expected inflation. Now, most of this inflation, as we've talked about a couple of times, is really not in goods. So that doesn't affect retail directly. It's mostly in services and housing costs. So this higher for longer interest rate narrative has reemerged. And then we also got, that was the U.S. in particular, but we also got not so good news in that both the U.K. and Japan have officially slipped into recession, just kind of shallowly, I guess you could say. I don't think this was totally unexpected, but definitely weaker economic outcomes in at least those two countries. And of course, we're seeing kind of the same picture across most of Western Europe.
Let's narrow the lens a little bit, talk about monthly sales for January. And I'm really getting to like the NRF CNBC data, because it does it is a slightly different slice and take on the data. And, there was a vibe that it wasn't a great month. I've just been doing a bunch of calls here and with retailers saying that January was a bit of a hangover from a good December month. But talk about what you saw in the NRF CNBC data for the month of January in the U.S.
Yes. So we've got both the NRF CNBC data, which folks that have been listening for a little bit know this new report started, I guess, back in the fall, and it comes from transactional data. So in theory, that's more accurate than the polling or the survey data that the U.S. Census Bureau puts out. But both of those came out this week. Generally, I would say pointed in the same direction, but there's some pretty big differences, and I just assume that's the survey methodology. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the headline was really that it was a pretty good month. Core retail, so that strips out things like fuel cost and automotive and mm-hmm. Things that are a little bit more volatile, was up 3.2%. And if you do believe that this narrative about there not being much goods inflation, you know, you would look at that and say, well, that would be a pretty strong real growth number. Overall, and this is part of the reason why I don't want to spend too much time on this, is the picture continues to be, in terms of differences among the different component pieces, pretty similar in that online continues to have above average growth. There tends to be strength in health and personal care. I mean, it was up almost 10%, which I think might be the strongest month in quite some time. I'm not quite sure I understand how that sector continues to be that strong. I mean, maybe just pricing power and mix. But clothing and accessories, which had been pretty weak this past year, was showed a little bit of signs of life. But in terms of the areas that are weak, building and garden supply down again, electronics and appliances down, furniture and home furnishings down. And I think we really should brace ourselves for some pretty bad news, because the department store number was also another terrible number, I think down 6-7%, something like that, which has pretty much been the pattern we've seen for the past several months. So, as I said, a little bit different from the Census Bureau numbers, but I would say the overall pattern continues to be that kind of the big ticket stuff and the department stores are quite negative, and online and health and beauty and kind of the more general merchandise, you know, more or less kind of on trend.
Speaking of department stores, some news out of the department store segment with Kohl's. We actually haven't talked about Kohl's in a bunch of episodes since they've had some changes in their people and they're trying to do a turnaround. But Singapore-based fund manager takes a stake in Kohl's. What's going on here?
Yeah. Well, I want to pause before we get into this, because a couple of weeks back, I criticized your segue. And this was actually a very, very, I mean, you pretty much stuck the landing on the segue there. Yeah, nice job. Yeah, this. But as far as the story, big institutional investor, GIC, that's, I guess, funded by the primarily by the Singapore government, bought 5.5 million shares, which is about 5% of the float of Kohl's. There already are some other outside shareholders, BlackRock and Vanguard, that have taken positions. So it seems like, you know, just kind of like we see people buzzing around Macy's. Kohl's has had interest in, you know, kind of these takeover funds potentially, or something to kind of force management. There's been activity on that front for several years now, but now it seems like it's picking up again. So some of this is that Kohl's performance, as we've talked about a bunch of times, has been pretty terrible over the last few years. The stock has been trading at about half of where it was 5 years ago. But on this news, the stock is creeping up. So maybe we'll see something happen with Kohl's before Macy's or some of the other firms that have been rumored to be takeover candidates or target of activist investors.
That's right. It's the Wobbly Unicorn time or segment.
We just can't stay away.
We just can't
stay away from the Wobbly Unicorn corner.
I think we should, maybe we should rename it, though it's kind of apocalyptic, the Disruptor Reckoning segment, because we got more news coming out of the Disruptor segment.
Well, people that heard my predictions episode know that I said that last year was the disruptor reset, and this year is more apocalyptic potentially. At least that's my prediction in terms of there being a reckoning. So some folks may remember Wish, which was kind of one of these early daily deal sites, I guess you could call them. It's kind of a hot brand for a hot minute. they got sold for $173 million. Now, I would take $173 million, but I suspect their investors weren't too thrilled with that. So they have, assuming the deal ultimately goes through, they will consolidated, mm-hmm. I guess, at a pretty good price. Also, Away, the luggage brand, direct-to-consumer, digitally native luggage brand, which has definitely got hurt, obviously, by the COVID times.
Yeah.
But I would have thought they would have bounced back better since people are traveling sure. like maniacs now. They seem to still be struggling. They've had some management changes, but they announced this past week that they were eliminating 25% of their staff and having a new management structure that's supposedly going to be more streamlined. So
25% less of their staff, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, if you get rid of a quarter of your people, you probably have to reorganize in some way, shape, or form. So, so that doesn't sound super optimistic, but hopefully that will get them on a path to better days.
Let's talk about Canada's tech darling, Shopify. Revenue's up 24%. Margin up 21%. Wall Street basically, whatever.
Kind of did a Shania Twain. That don't impress me much.
Very good. Look at you.
Yeah, I want to lean into our 90s references. Was she 90s?
Hey, boomer.
For everybody under 40, they're like, okay, you guys old.
Like, what's it going to take for Wall Street to get excited? I mean, I can think of one thing. That would be an appearance by their leadership on the Remarkable Retail podcast. But
I mean, obviously. Just the hit to their stock, or not the hit, sorry. Just the, Freudian slip. Just the bounce,
yes.
Harley, to their Toby, to their, anyway. We had a bunch of earnings this week, and Shopify was the one. And by the way, I was thinking, why do we talk about earnings? This is not an investor podcast, but to me, it's often, an indication of what's going on more broadly. So it's not so much that, I'm not in the business of recommending stocks, though. If you had shorted Wayfair, you would have done quite well.
Thank you, Scott.
Shopify obviously is really the main force behind not just small business e-commerce, but, primarily small, medium-sized businesses. And so when you look at the growth in e-commerce, they obviously, they had some struggles, frankly, because they kind of overinvested during the COVID times. But it seems like they've really gotten this business back on track. So not only are their revenues up a lot, but their free cash flow margin is up to 21%, which is, that seems pretty darn profitable.
It's pretty solid to me.
It's interesting. I don't know if they've kind of lost, they've lost that love and feeling or something because of some of the disappointments that happened, a year or two back. But anyway, they seem to be on a good trajectory. And when you look at the e-commerce growth, if you think about Amazon's retail is, primarily, online only, not very big in physical retail. You look at the growth you see in big players like Walmart. I mean, so much of the growth is really concentrated with a few retailers or platforms. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of interesting. And a lot of the other companies are not doing so well. So I think it's noteworthy just in terms of the consolidation that's occurring with a few big players in the online space.
And Shopify's got their enterprise version, Shopify Plus, and then they have in-store, right? They got POS, point of sale in-store. So not like they're ignoring the phenomenon around the growth of stores and the success and durability of stores.
Sure.
Let's talk about Under Armour. So they got a newish CEO, revenue and income, not so great though in fiscal Q3.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I think are interesting here. One is, and I think we talked about this when Stephanie went over there to become the CEO, that here was somebody from outside of retail because she was the, I believe, president, not CEO, but president at Marriott, a big hotel player. So not an obvious background for, or at least not the traditional background for a retailer. And also at the same time, we've seen so much growth in the kind of athleisure space, yet Under Armour has really struggled. Now, I don't know, part of what was embedded within their results was that their direct-to-consumer business was up, and then, their wholesale business, therefore, would have been down. D2C now is up to 45% or so of their total mix. So I don't know if Under Armour's problems really are I have to say they got to be partially tied to the weakness in the department store space and, some of their wholesale partners. So they're caught up in that. And so their diversification away from that perhaps long-term will serve them well. But at least so far, definitely struggling to really move towards positive revenue growth and growing their net income.
Let's get to our interview with Beth Ann in a minute, but first let's have a few words from our presenting sponsor, Celonis. Want to ramp up speed and productivity for your entire retail operation? In the Celonis Process Mining for Dummies Handbook, we show you how Celonis Process Mining technology, enhanced with Process Intelligent AI, can help you streamline performance across your entire retail business so you can drive lasting value from end to end. That means purchasing, supply chain, omni-channel execution, merchandising, and customer service processes, all managed and optimized through one powerful software solution. To get your free copy of Process Mining for Dummies and see how it's generated millions in value for brands around the world like Aldi, Globus, and Edeka, head to Celonis.com/remarkableretail.
Beth Ann, welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast. We're delighted to have you. Where do we find you today?
You find me in brisk New York, but there is no snow in the ground anymore, so I'm sunny and happy.
All right. Well, I was going to say brisk New York. Is that like out on the island, a town I don't know about? But now I understand
what you're talking about.
Weather-wise, no, I'm tracking. Well, I happen to be in sunny Florida visiting my sister, so I'm away from any crud and enjoying dolphins swimming by and all that kind of stuff. But I don't want to make you feel jealous. Let's get to what we're here to talk about.
Too late for that.
I know. Let's, just to kind of get things started, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, your professional journey, the work you do today. And then I think in particular, because of all the kind of alphabet soup of some agencies, maybe you can give us a little bit of background on the company and your part of the VML world.
That sounds great. I somehow serendipitously have ended up in this wonderful world of commerce. And I guess some of it has been more intentional than I'm making it sound. So I've been on the professional services side for most of my career, including I consider my CMO time as, you know, very much professional services, because I was working for Westfield, which was going through massive transformation into how do you digitally transform, how do you think through consumer experience, how do you become an experience and technology brand that is offering more than just retail to the customer. And so it really took from all, you know, kind of interests in my own career background and journey. I always laugh at that word journey. It's a very American expression, but we'll come back to that. And so I've had a mix of getting to run great agencies and also transform those agencies. And usually it was transforming them closer to things like the point of purchase or what got to the combination of creativity and commercial result. And then coined the expression when I was at Geometry of creative commerce, was probably doing creative commerce at Westfield and in many of my other roles before that. Also got a chance to create consulting at Kantar and really lead CMOs on a journey of transformation of bringing brand marketing together with retail and commerce solutions. And now within my WPP time have been able to go from, transforming Geometry and bringing it into this creative commerce space, turning that into VML Y&R Commerce as part of the VML Y&R family. And then now as we merge with the wonderful Wunderman Thompson, which had strong commerce, especially commerce and technology capability, bringing that together as part of VML, where we are delivering a connected brands proposition for our clients that has a unique combination of brand experience, consumer experience, and commerce coming together, but also has this very rich enterprise solutions area of our business, which is much more technology-driven, designed for a CIO, CDO, or CTO buyer, and has, you know, a lot of really heavy commerce technology at the heart of what we're delivering.
Well, how would you, I mean, you talked a little bit about kind of the through line or the connective tissue in the work you do. Maybe you could just kind of circle back to that a little bit and kind of why you've gravitated to the places you've been, but also particularly since you have had this diverse experience. And I thought the Westfield, when I saw that in your background, I'd actually forgotten about that you had been at Westfield. How has your view shifted, or how have things evolved in your career over the last, say, decade or so?
Well, I guess the through line for me has always been around some version of integrated marketing. and innovation kind of propelling that forward into reality. So it wasn't just a concept. It was something that clients actually really needed. And it was because the industries were being more and more technology fueled, and innovation for company was what was driving growth, as well as the story you're telling and what you're marketing in terms of your brands and your products. And so I've always been interested in things that felt a little bit more pioneering, what was more traditional, both in terms of just leadership style and sentiment and attitude, as well as the offer that I was always helping to assemble or articulate our narrative was, what we were giving to the industry that was distinct and different. And so the language of commerce wasn't in my mind from the beginning necessarily, but I was always interested in probably what would have been considered before below the line or lower funnel activation oriented work. What brands do, not just what they say, was very interesting to me. I felt like it was rich, beyond tactic, and oftentimes was diminished in value or was seen very tactically. And so I just love the idea of kind of bringing a strategic bent and a really strong creative element to things that would have typically been in that kind of activation below the line space. And that was more tangible and measurable. And I just always felt with what was happening in media and how the consumer was shifting and how our channels were shifting, that was going to become a more fertile space of marketing and was going to become more interesting for both employees and for our clients. And so I kind of just kept placing my bets there, trying to personally enrich that space with my own thought leadership and the companies that I was a part of, and then and watch it evolve as it has today. And of course, there's always the incredible forces of change that you can't predict, like the pandemic, which put commerce language front and center in the marketing verse now.
Yeah, as an accelerant or in some places as just transformed some industries. And it's interesting because we often talk to leaders who have this innate skill that I'm just reflecting on what you're saying, that they kind of, as we would say in Canada, like the Wayne Gretzky, I go to where I think the puck is going to be. And it sounds like that's been like a through line for you, is that you kind of anticipated some growth. We are here today on the mic, thanks to our friends at the World Retail Congress, their big event coming up in Paris this April. Now, their theme is high performance retail. So we couldn't get someone like you on the mic without asking you, when you heard that title, what do you think is high performance retail? Not that it's your phrase exactly. And when you think of the context of high performance retailer, what do you think is on the agency side or on the service side? And what do you think that means to customers? Like, what do you think retailers should be focusing on? And what do they think they need to do to survive 24 and actually thrive beyond 24?
Well, I love the question and I love the title. It resonated with me immediately, and I felt so grateful to be invited. And I'll go back to the Wayne Gretzky quote, which is one that I've always used in my career. I happen to be an ice hockey fan a Wayne Gretzky fan, so it combines all those things for me. But it is at the heart of how you think about performance and high performance. How are you building teams and building business in a sustainable way, but that is still projecting what's to come and leveraging some of the newer capability that exists, or some of it's not new, but we are thinking of it in newer ways, such as generative AI, but is leveraging it in ways that is going to make our business both more sustainable and then higher performance. And so when I think about that from a retail standpoint, the economics of retail are not just changing, but opening up in, I think, really both creative, innovative, and exciting ways. And we used to laugh a little bit at the language of omnichannel and sometimes think, well, what does that actually really mean? But actually, I think today it does mean something. And I think that the retailer environments and thinking of them as marketplaces and ecosystems, and it's not just about a Walmart or an Amazon. It can be about almost any major retailer or even small retailers that are just thinking differently about their business and how they're serving their consumer. I think they have an incredible opportunity right now to monetize things. And this was exactly my role at Westfield. You know, how do we think about what we were able to monetize that we couldn't before? How do we think about the people who were flowing through our spaces, not just as somebody else's consumer, you know, coming because the Apple Store was there or Sephora was there, but that actually were a captive audience and they were choosing to come to a Westfield, of which there's also an Apple Store and a Sephora.
Right.
And so how do we think about monetizing those audiences or creating more assets, quite honestly, that would make it stickier and make it more engaging and make them feel like they were part of a community and all the great things that we do as marketers today in connection to retailing. And so to your second part of that question around kind of the agency opportunity, I think is, you know, magnificent in this because it's really about how we bring together teams that aren't just media agnostic, marketing agnostic, come from advertising backgrounds or came from shopper marketing or retail backgrounds, but are bringing in diverse teams that are able to think about all those areas holistically and be a true partner to both our manufacturers and how they are able to win in retail, but also the retail environments that are really looking for how do I prioritize the things that I should be transforming in my business.
Let me follow up on that point quickly. I mean, when I think about leaders like yourself, you're trying to parse the signal from the noise. Like, to use your term creative commerce, like, how do you understand when it's too creative commerce? Like, we've got a segment on the show called The Wobbly Unicorns where, you know, we kind of look sideways at some business models and we're like, we don't even understand how that new business model works. But sometimes they do. How do you parse that out that, you know, it's a new model, but it's so new, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense? We've kind of seen that happen a little bit. Do you reflect on that sometimes?
We do. And we have growth models that help, you know, weight projections and understand where we would place some bets or what we think makes sense for our clients. The other point is usually, what's the outcome we're trying to drive for our client, or what's the problem we're trying to solve? And does this make sense to experiment around, trial around? Can you pilot? You don't, you know, not necessarily bet the farm and go big, but are there things that we can do here to see whether this is going to be beneficial? Is it going to, if it's small, like we've done things where, let's say, as part of the Amazon ecosystem, we're using voice commerce and it's solving a pain point that we have in a part of the world, may not be applicable to every market, but because of how viral and relevant it is for consumers, it may get shared around the world. And so it's looking at marketing in a new way. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the right metric that we can attach to this. And the other that we're all familiar with is just the data piece. And is this something that generates a first party data or a different intelligent insight into our consumer that then is going to be something that we can feed across other things that we are doing? And so it doesn't necessarily need to be the big hit, but what we're getting from it with the intentional design up front is something that is going to be of real value for our business.
So I want to shift gears in just a minute to some of the reports and trend work that you and your firm have been doing. But just quickly, because I was taking a look at the World Retail Congress agenda, and I happened to notice that your session will be, I think, pretty much right up front on day one, and you're actually going to be on stage with Deloitte's Ira Kalish, who longtime listeners will know has been a guest on the podcast twice, and Andrea Dracides from the Blackstone Group. I don't know if you guys have worked out yet what you think you're going to be talking about, but maybe you could kind of give us a sense for what you think you're going to be, the kind of knowledge you're going to be dropping on stage.
Well, first of all, I feel, again, very honored and fortunate to be on stage with such incredible leaders. And if I were to guess, they are going to bring some heavy-duty, quantifiable insight into where things are headed. And so while we have some of that, I think what I'll do is probably augment what they're going to be presenting, but also bring a bit more of the consumer-centric view that we are maniacally focused on for our clients and the way we think about the business, as well as some great working examples of creative commerce in action and some of the work that we've been doing really successfully with our clients and where we see that going, not just where it's had impact so far, but where we also see that continuing to evolve and innovate.
Steve mentioned that your firms are putting out some fantastic reports. We were looking at the Future Shopper Report and the Future 100 You know, great reports. We won't go into them in any depth here, but if we could ask you, you know, what one, two, or even three kind of key takeaways from those reports that we haven't talked about already that you'd want our listeners to understand. We'll put links in the show notes so they can go find the reports. But what jumps out at you when you've got this great team that puts these reports together and you collaborate with them? What jumps out at you that you'd want to share?
Well, I'll start with the Future 100 and then make my way into the retail report specifically, because the one overarching thematic that came through the Future 100 that, you know, also was relevant to the other report and I think to everything that we all do today was this idea of emotioneering. And the reason I love it is because there's so much around performance, precision marketing, programmatic, and the digitization or automation of so much of what we do today. You can easily get so wrapped up in that you lose the humanity, that you lose the emotion, and you lose the thing that makes brands stand out for people and why they buy, even at the retail level, at the master brand retail level. And so I think that, and you can see the different players who are fighting to have an emotional rich context that they still live in and the place that they hold in the consumers' hearts and minds. You look at some of the China brands, I think they've done that actually really well. They've been, you know, hard hitting, huge mega brands and mega marketplaces, but yet you just know that they emotionally live in the lifestyle of their consumer in such a lived and alive way. And so that's one thing that I think we're going to be really drawing upon in how we think about the work that we do this year. And then when I get more specific to the retail, one thing that I've talked to, because we obviously have a lot, we have brands that are across the spectrum, small, medium businesses, all the way up to enterprise, but they're brands that most people would recognize. And I think one thing that happens with big companies is, and this is true for retailers or manufacturers, is that you underestimate the disruption that can come from small players that are seemingly overnight. Usually that it's not overnight. We know that there's backstories and there's years of getting a go-to-market model right for whatever business you are. But you have the ability to disrupt in ways that you never did before and really quickly. So if you take, I'll just use, for example, on the manufacturing side, Pink Stuff, that is very DTC, leverages TikTok, and starts off as one pink goopy stuff that cleans up things. But then before you know it, has an entire portfolio of product that is disrupting a lot of our clients, you know, hugely effective, efficacy-driven, wonderful brands and products that have been around on our shelves as dominant players for a very long time. And so we have a massive trend in the retail side that is about not being surprised by them and not playing defense. But how do we get our clients in a place where they're playing offense?
Well, it's actually funny you use that example because, and I was going to ask you a question about this anyway, but I'm working on an article that is kind of a sub or derived, I guess, from my new book about this idea that safe is risky. And part of kind of my support for that is exactly what you're saying, is that companies underestimate how quickly things can be changing, and whether that's technology or consumer preferences, but also how these disruptive brands can come out of what often looks like nowhere. But as you say, sometimes it's not actually that fast. But I'm curious, when you work with clients, whether you're trying to get them to push a creative idea or a creative execution more, or you're just trying to get them to fundamentally see the competitive landscape, consumer landscape in a different way, how do you go about doing that? And I guess even just maybe before that, do you agree with this idea that safe is often the riskiest thing you can do?
Oh, we fully believe that. And that's why our approach is called Brave. And so there's two pieces to that. One is very evidence-based, data-driven, because most times when clients want to play it safe, it's because they're protecting the top line and bottom line, or either or, and they are measured and incentivized through certain KPIs. And so first, I always tell every agency person, especially great client engagement people, you really need to understand the business of the business of who of the clients you're serving, and also how your day-to-day clients are KPI'd, and because it helps you understand behavior and choices the best. But I think what we did in our space in particular, because we were kind of pioneering and driving, you know, work that was on brief, but coming from a different place in the organization oftentimes, and would you'd have to make a media trade-off of this is going to maybe take budget from somewhere else that is where it's being applied. And so oftentimes our clients would know immediately this was the right thing to do, or they would get so excited by the work, but then their next natural instinct was to say, but I don't even know how to navigate my company to get this in front of the right people, or I've never even been in front of those people before, or there's going to be a defensive internal motion because they didn't think of this idea, or they're already doing this other big idea project. And so we really had to orchestrate both within our own people as well as within our clients, this sense of this is about being brave. And we had to kind of arm our clients with the ability to navigate their own organizations with the right sell-in behind these ideas. And one of the things that we also really found in our own work was that it's very hard when you truly are, like, let's take the idea of creative commerce. When you're pioneering a new space like this, you don't really know what it looks like. If I said to you, 15-second, 30-second ad, or even, when with Amazon Prime going into the ad space, you start to visualize, well, what does an Amazon Prime ad look like? Mm-hmm. You're not trying to figure out what that means. You kind of have a visual sense already based on what's come before. When you start talking creative commerce and you start thinking about the new tools and capabilities and skills that exist within a retailer, and or exists within a retailer plus an NBC Universal plus a TikTok, it's very different. You know, you've got such different tools that you're using to create and put together an idea that also oftentimes has AI generating thinking behind it. Sure. And so you really start to have to show it a lot more. So we would do these reverse case studies where we would create videos of the idea already created and already winning like a Cannes Award for creative commerce. So it showed measurable result. It showed how the consumer was going to be reacting. It showed the viral impact and buzz it was going to generate, and told the story from that standpoint in a way that was familiar to the internal audiences and got people so excited. And then before you knew it, we were bringing those things to life.
Super, super interesting. Now, speaking of becoming excited, what are you excited about this year? It's a short question. You've got a global remit. So what, as you think about 2024, what are you most excited about?
Gosh, there's a lot. first of all, we're in a really cool position at WPP right now with the size and scale of VML. And it's not lost on any of us of the impact we want to make with that for our clients. And I think it is about how do we simplify things for our clients? We're all living with so much more complexity. How do we bring capability in a much simpler user interface together for our clients? And so that we take kind of the navigation and the picking and choosing out of the equation for them a little bit, we can get to things that are going to be meaningful and, you know, driving value for their business much faster. And then tied to that, we can think about the full value chain in a much more holistic way than I think we could have before, because we're really trying to break down even our own silos to bring the kind of adjacent offer and the things that really think through how do you drive more value across the full value chain of the consumer experience to our clients. And so that gets really exciting. Like, we're growing offer, not just through the verticalization of commerce, but through where commerce and consumer experience comes together, where commerce and brand experience comes together, which I think gets really exciting. And then there's the media piece of it. And I've always had a little bit of a media nerd in me, or, you know, that's been a side hustle of just even figuring it out. And you can kind of say the same thing with technology and AI right now. It's a great time for nerds to get creative.
It's a great time to be a nerd. It's nerd. Right.
And have a better seat at the table.
Finally, finally.
It excites me. It excites me.
Well, listen, this has been a great conversation. How do folks get in touch with you or learn more about the work and the agency and just find out about all the great things you're thinking?
Well, we made our name simpler, so vml.com.
Step one.
My name is not that simple, but Beth Ann Kam & Co. I'm on LinkedIn and very easy to find, start following or finding our agency. We also do a lot of thought leadership under VML Commerce. And I'm very, you know, our inboxes and our multiple inboxes now get full very fast, but I'm pretty good about following up and helping people navigate their ways in to either our business or WPP's business, getting client connections going that might be really beneficial. So yeah, VML and Beth Ann.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well, Beth Ann, thanks so much for joining us on the mic. Look forward to encourage anybody who can hear the sound of my voice, our voice, to if they're happen to be in Paris or want to get to the World Retail Congress to go sit and listen to the panel. So thanks again so much for joining Steve and I on the mic, and we wish you a great 2024, continued success, and we'll be watching because you guys put out some great stuff.
Thank you both so much. This was fun.
Well, that was a great interview with Beth Ann, by the way, and thanks again to our friends from World Retail Congress for helping make it happen. They got a great roster of speakers, and I don't think we've had a lot of agency people, so to speak. We've certainly had consultants on the show, and mm-hmm. I had to laugh when you talked about the alphabet soup of letters, because I think including myself, to the average, once I started looking at what agencies and what encompassed all those kind of bodies of work, and of course, she's got an amazing background at Kantar. It's interesting. They frame things so well, but they're trying to unpack a lot of complexity even within their organization and move that forward, right? So I think they're a model for, I think they are the model for what they propose for their clients to do.
Yeah, I think so. It is sometimes hard to understand how that all comes together. And we don't, you and I were talking about this off mic. We don't have that many, aside from not really having agency folks on, we just don't have that many service providers on the podcast, at least the last several seasons. And some of that is, we're trying to showcase remarkable retailers. Mm-hmm. But I'm finding, and very much true with Beth Ann, having that perspective, not only the global perspective, but having that perspective across so many different kinds of mm-hmm. retailers, consumer companies, big, small, and everywhere in between kind of companies. And you just get to see so much. And if you're good, which you have to be to have her job or working in that space, if you're good at teasing out these insights, trying to figure out how to frame it and get your clients to take action, that's such a valuable perspective. The other thing I was just going to say was that, it's kind of funny with all the lingo. She was saying she's kind of rallying around omnichannel a little bit more. I saw a bunch of things last week about this idea of adaptive retail, which is kind of omnichannel-ish. But I'm not trying to throw more semantics in here, but I think one of the things that's really interesting is this, all these opportunities that are created by these boundaries coming down. It's so much easier to put together a bundled offering, whether we're talking about, selling products, but also having a media network or products and services together. But some of that is with the digitization, with the power of the cloud, but this boundaryless kind of world we live in, it just allows so many more interesting combinations. Plus, consumers are just more used to it, right? It's not such a siloed purchasing behavior. So whatever we call it, I think this idea of a brand as a platform and this ability to kind of unbundle or rebundle things does create some powerful new opportunities. So, I think creative commerce is a really interesting term. But it's not so much about the semantics or whether you like the particular phrasing. It's, what is it really about and what do you need to respond to or ideally turn to your advantage?
I did like her optimism, certainly about that smaller, innovative, nimble players. Again, maybe they're not, they're the 5-year overnight success kind of players, but that there is still, the disruptors can still disrupt. I mean, I think we're a little hard on them sometimes with the wobbly unicorn segment, but, demonstrably there is still innovation.
But does it get laughs, Michael? That's what I mean. You come here for the insight and you come here for the laughs. And sometimes,
sometimes
we say the wrong thing, but it's funny. And even when we have an opportunity to edit it out, we still leave it in. What does that say about
I don't know
us?
What does that say about us? I don't know. I guess. Anyway, I thought it was a great interview, and she left me feeling very good, very positive about both their work and the prospects for innovation and stuff that you and I really care about in retail. So let's leave it there. Thanks for tuning in. New episodes of Season 8 presented by Celonis will show up every Tuesday. So be sure to tell your friends and colleagues in the retail industry all about us.
I'm Steve Dennis, author of the best-selling book, Remarkable Retail, and my new forthcoming book, Leaders Leap, Transforming Your Company at the Speed of Disruption, which will be published in April and is available for pre-order at booksellers everywhere. You can learn more about me, my consulting, and keynote speaking at stephenpdennis.com.
I'm Michael LeBlanc, consumer retail growth consultant, keynote speaker, producer, and host of a series of retail trade podcasts, including this one. You can learn more about me on LinkedIn. Safe travels, everyone.